The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Yvonne, and thank you to the Philadelphia Free Public Library for hosting me this evening. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak to you. This book represents the end of a long journey for me, which began some 35 years ago in 1973, when I was a student from Australia, hence the accent, in Jerusalem, where I was about to start a master's course in international relations, when the 1973 Yom Kippur War broke out. It was a surprise attack by Egypt and Syria. I was in Jerusalem. I worked as a volunteer there and then went to a kibbutz and worked there in the south near the Egyptian border. It was during those dark nights that I would listen to the drone of C-130 Hercules aircraft flying in emergency military supplies for the Israeli army. And then on my radio, listening to BBC reports — they didn't have CNN in those days — of Henry Kissinger flying in to effect a ceasefire, and then to begin the negotiations which led to the first agreements between Israel and Egypt, the disengagement agreements, and that eventually laid the basis for the peace process as we came to know it, that led to the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, the Israel-Syria disengagement agreement, and so on. And it was during those days that I had a kind of epiphany that I was going to devote my life to understanding the role that the United States could play in the resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Henry Kissinger became my hero, subsequently Anwar Sadat. And I became a teacher, a lecturer, a writer that focused on this. And then by a series of serendipitous developments, ended up 20 years later, in the beginning of 1993, entering the White House with a new president as his Middle East advisor. And it was in those days, in January 1993, that I was responsible for briefing President Clinton on what he should do with the Middle East. And I told him that the stars were in alignment for an opportunity for him to make comprehensive peace in the Middle East, that the collapse of the Soviet Union, the defeat of Saddam Hussein's army in Kuwait, and the fact that now all the Arab states and the Palestinians were sitting in direct negotiations with Israel, and Yitzhak Rabin had just been elected Prime Minister of Israel with a mandate to take risks for peace, that this combination of these circumstances, or if you like, the alignment of all of these stars, had created an opportunity where, if he put his mind to it, he could, within his first term in office, I said rather boldly, achieve an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And he looked at me and said, "I want to do that." And as simple as that, or so we thought. And so, for the next 8 years, he devoted a good part of his presidency, of his energy, of the prestige of his office, to the effort to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. For the first 2 years, it seemed like my prophecy was coming true. We had Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin with their historic handshake on the White House lawn in September 1993. We had in Wadi Arava on the border between Israel and Jordan in October 1994, the signing of the Israel-Jordan peace treaty. And at the beginning of 1995, President Clinton sent me out to Israel to be his ambassador, the first Jewish Australian American ambassador to Israel, to help Yitzhak Rabin work on the peace deal that we thought we were about to finalize on the Syrian track, where we had secretly conveyed Yitzhak Rabin's commitment to Hafez al-Assad, the leader of Syria, that he would commit his nation to a full withdrawal from the Golan Heights to the line of June 4, 67 in return for peace with Syria. And we were just kind of negotiating the details at that point. But I went out there to Israel with the expectation that we would get the Syrian deal and that that would lead to a Lebanese-Israeli peace deal and it would be finished. The conflict would be over. 5 months later, Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. And the whole process began to crater. Bibi Netanyahu he defeated Shimon Peres in election and formed a narrow right-wing government that was incapable of going ahead with the fulfillment of the commitments made by the Israeli government on the Palestinian track. And with the slowing of the peace process, the whole broader effort in the Middle East to contain Saddam Hussein and contain the radical mullahs in Iran also started to come apart. I went back to Washington, was Assistant Secretary of State under Madeleine Albright in the second Clinton term with responsibility for the Middle East. And we really found it very hard going. Whereas before the wind had been at our backs, now it was in our face. And it was a very hard slog and we made very little progress. Finally, President Clinton convinced Bibi Netanyahu to give up 13.1% of the West Bank in an interim deal with Yasser Arafat. And once he did that, his government collapsed. And suddenly, Ehud Barak was elected Prime Minister of Israel with a mandate, again, to take risks for peace. He came to Washington in mid-1999 and told President Clinton that he wanted to fulfill Rabin's legacy and end the conflict in his first year in office and Bill Clinton's last year in office. And by the way, he said, I want you to send Martin Indyk back to work with me on this. So I went back to Israel as ambassador, beginning of 2000, with the sense that here was a second chance to fulfill Rabin's legacy and to fulfill my prophecy that we would succeed in ending the Arab-Israeli conflict. And 5 months later, the whole process cratered again. We found ourselves in circumstances in which President Assad of Syria, coming to the end of his life, having played around with us for 7 years, suddenly decided in December of 1999 that he actually wanted to conclude the deal. And he had only one condition, which was to do it quickly. Quickly was a word we never heard from Assad. He used to tell us, haste is from the devil. That's a famous Arab proverb. But suddenly he wanted to end it before his life was over. And we went for that deal, and it was a tragedy that we missed it. It was like ships passing in the night. Assad was ready. Barak was not, because he felt that he didn't have the Israeli public behind him and needed more time to show them that he was a tough bargainer. Excuse me. And then when Barak was ready, 3 months later, and Clinton took to Assad a map that showed the Israeli line of withdrawal off the Golan Heights to a line based on the line of June 4th, 67, with only the only issue left to negotiate was a narrow strip around the northeast sector of the Sea of Galilee. And Assad, it was by that time too late. Assad said no. I think by that time he had only one act left in him, which was to put his son in power, common kind of thing in the Arab world. And he said no. And when we missed that deal, it changed the whole dynamic when we turned to try to conclude a final status agreement with Yasser Arafat on the Palestinian track. Camp David, Barak made a generous offer, but Arafat refused it. I think he had good reason to do so at that time. But then Barak and Clinton continued to pursue Arafat and try to get him to accept an ever-improving offer, even though by that point the Intifada had broken out, there was violence, the Israeli public was turning against the deal, but Barak and Clinton were determined. But with Arafat now in the catbird seat, realizing how much he was being pursued, he felt no real pressure to make the deal. And at the end of Clinton's time in office, when he put on the table what became known as the Clinton parameters for the creation of an independent Palestinian state in all of Gaza and some 94 to 97% of the West Bank, the borders would have to be negotiated, with territorial compensation for that 3 to 6% that would be ceded to Israel, and a corridor connecting the two parts of the Palestinian state and a fair resolution of the refugee problem and Palestinian sovereignty in the Arab suburbs of Jerusalem and in the Muslim and Christian quarters of the Old City and on the top of the Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque was based, Palestinian sovereignty there too. When Arafat was offered this deal, which he had led us to believe was what he needed, he preferred to listen to those of his advisors who said, wait for George Bush, he'll get you a better deal. Shimon Peres at the time said to me that history is like a horse that gallops past your window, and the test of statesmanship is to jump on that horse. Now, if you think about it, it's not such an easy proposition. Arafat decided to let history's horse pass him by at that critical moment. And as a consequence, Palestinians and Israelis have been locked in a horrendous conflict ever since, in which the war in Gaza is just the latest episode. I stayed on at President Bush's request for 6 months while he got another ambassador to take over from me. That was a period in which Ariel Sharon defeated Ehud Barak in a snap election, and I accompanied Sharon on his first visit back to Washington to meet with President Bush. And after that meeting, which I describe in some humorous detail in the book, President Bush asked me to stay behind for a minute. He knew, we'd never met, but he knew me as part of Clinton's peace team, and he said to me, what happened? And I said, well, Mr. President, there's a lot of blame to go around, but essentially it comes down to a lack of leadership. And he stopped me. I had a few other things to say, but stopped me. He said, that's right. No leadership. Barak and Clinton were two desperate men chasing after Arafat. They made him a very generous offer. He rejected it and resorted to violence. And now Sharon is taken Barak's place. He's not going to offer what Arafat has already rejected. So there's no peace deal to be made here. No Nobel Peace Prize to be had. And he gave me that smile of his, and that was the end of the conversation. Now, if you think about it, his analysis was correct, but his prescription was fundamentally wrong, because what he decided to do was to walk away from that effort to make peace. Colin Powell, his Secretary of the State, on his first visit to Israel, when I hosted him there, said to me as I was driving him back to the airport, "I think we're going to park this problem for a while." And I protested. I said, "Mr. Secretary, you know, you can't park this car. It's on a hill and it doesn't have any brakes." But, you know, I was a member of Clinton's team, so they were not in the mood to listen. And instead, the United States walked away from the effort to try to resolve the conflict, and Bush let the Israelis and Palestinians have at it, which is what they did. And in the process, the whole edifice of peacemaking that had been constructed, not just in Clinton's 8 years, but in essentially stretching back 30 years to that beginning of the process by Henry Kissinger, that edifice was consumed in the flames of violence. For me, it was a very personal failure, and one that it took me some time to come to terms with, which is what I've tried to do in this book. Tried to learn the lessons of our mistakes there in trying to resolve the conflict, but also in trying to deal with the rogue regimes of Iraq and Iran, which I also had responsibility for. And what I tried to do was to take this concept of the lantern on the stern that Barbara Tuchman talks about in her book, March of Folly, to try to shine a light on the wake that we left behind and that has been roiled by the missteps of the Bush administration, in the belief that one day a new president would come along who would dedicate the United States again to the task of making peace in the Middle East, and that somehow the lessons from that last sustained effort could help to guide him. I had no idea that when I was writing this book that Barack Obama would become president, and that he would, in his second day in office, do just that and appoint George Mitchell to be his envoy for the purposes of trying to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. So what are the lessons for this new president as he embarks on this effort? I called this book Innocent Abroad, borrowing on Mark Twain's title for the book in which he describes his pilgrimage to the Holy Land and his encounter with the people and ways of the Middle East. Because therein it seemed to me to lie the first lesson from our encounter with the Middle East. And it is that there is something quintessentially innocent about America's approach to the region. And it is both wonderful and terrible. Wonderful in the sense that we feel, as Americans, an obligation to try to heal the wounds of this troubled region and to invest not only our treasure and our diplomatic energies, but as we see in the war in Iraq, our blood as well, the blood of our young men and women, for the purposes of trying to transform this region. But the dark side of that innocence is an ignorance and an arrogance. An ignorance about the differences between the Middle East and the United States. We tend to assume that they're like us, that we can make this part of the world over in our own image. Clinton tried to do it as make it a more peaceful place. Bush tried to make it a more democratic place. They both failed. And in part they failed because of a lack of understanding and sensitivity to the history and culture and values of a region that is in fact very different to our own United States of America. And there's an arrogance there as well, that we assume that because we have the power and the ideas, that we can somehow impose our notions in this part of the world. And the reaction of this part of the world is to reject it, to resist it, to twist our good intentions in a way that suits their interests and not necessarily ours. And so, therefore, the first lesson is to be more sensitive to the differences, more aware of the cross currents of that troubled region, more humble in our approach, more realistic in our objectives. I think Barack Obama understands that already in the way that he's approaching it. The second lesson is the conclusion that Bill Clinton reached in his last year in office, when people warned him that this was going to be very difficult to try to end the conflict. He said it to me at Camp David, he said, you know, it's better that we try, even if we fail, than not to try at all. And George Bush reached the opposite conclusion. In many ways, it was not surprising because Clinton had failed. He reached the conclusion it was better not to try than to fail. And that was a fundamental mistake. And part of the mistake was not only to dismiss the effort, but to dismiss the means as well. I remember one of Bush's senior advisors who had responsibility for the Middle East said to me in those early Bush years, we don't do diplomacy, we do policy. And diplomacy took on a very bad odor in the Bush administration. And that is part of the lesson, the second lesson. That diplomacy is in fact a noble pursuit. It's not a sign of weakness. It's backed by the potential threat of force. It can be a very effective way to achieve our objectives if used effectively. The third lesson is about where our strengths lie. Our weaknesses lie in not being able to understand very well what motivates these leaders. Our strength lies in our power to affect their calculations. We are, notwithstanding the tying down of our military forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and the tarnishing of our brand name in this part of the world, we are still the superpower, and we still wield immense influence. And we can shape the strategic context in which the leaders in that part of the world make their decisions. The strategic context now is one in which Iran is making a bid for dominance in the region, where it is using its alliance with Syria and its proxies Hezbollah and Hamas to spread its influence into the Arab-Israeli heartland of the Middle East, right up to the southern and northern borders of Israel. And it is coming to the people of the Arab world with a message that is, our way works. Violence, terrorism, defiance of the international community, threats to destroy Israel. That's the way to achieve justice and dignity for the Palestinians and the Arabs. And this is the message that Hamas sends and Hezbollah sends. And they have things to point to to bolster that narrative. And shaping the strategic context now means that President Obama has to show that our way works, that an American-led effort to restructure the region so that we establish with our allies in the region, Israel, the Arab states, and our and the international community, we try to reshape a more peaceful order in that region. And to do so by showing that peacemaking can actually deliver what violence and terrorism cannot. And that's where the diplomacy of peacemaking becomes so important. At the same time, we have to find ways of dealing with this Iranian bid for dominance, a bid that is backed by an Iranian effort to acquire nuclear weapons capabilities, which enhances its message and threatens to trigger a nuclear arms race in the region, if not an Israeli military strike, which could set the region ablaze again. So there is a very big challenge here for President Obama to use his power and influence to launch three simultaneous initiatives. The first on the Palestinian track to try to rebuild capability for negotiations and reinstill faith that a two-state solution can in fact resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The second is to pick up the work that the Turks did in the last year between Israel and Syria to lay the foundations for an Israeli-Syrian peace negotiation. The Bush administration didn't want to have anything to do with this, even though Israel wanted to make peace with Syria. But the basic foundations have been laid. And now there is an opportunity to pick that up quite quickly. It is, I think, no coincidence that George Mitchell is on his way to Ankara tonight and that Hillary Clinton will end her Middle East tour, which she's making next week, in Ankara as well. Because there is diplomatic work to be done with the Turks to get this Israeli-Syrian negotiation going. And at the same time, to pursue an engagement, diplomatic engagement with Iran in an attempt to head off their nuclear program and to give them the option of becoming part of this new, more peaceful order that we're trying to create there. Or if they choose not to be part of it, it will be their choice. We will not be isolating them. They will be isolating themselves. The fourth lesson, as Obama tries to pursue this three-pronged strategy, is to stay flexible. What's very clear is that the United States cannot determine exactly how the leaders will respond to our efforts. What we've found historically is that when we push on one door, another door opens. It's the history of unintended consequences in the Middle East. So Jimmy Carter, for instance, when he began his presidency and wanted to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, went off to Damascus to try to bring them into the process. Anwar Sadat became very impatient, stood up and said, "I'm ready to go to the ends of the earth, even to Jerusalem, to make peace," and diverted our whole effort back to his negotiation with Israel. Bill Clinton went off to Syria to try to make peace between Israel and Syria first, and we ended up with Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn. And then we tried again, detailed in my book, to bring the Syrians into the game, and the King Hussein of Jordan ended up on the south lawn of the White House with Yitzhak Rabin. So what's important here is not to stick rigidly with our game plan, but to seize the opportunities that our efforts can help to produce. A corollary of that is that we have to keep our radar tuned for those moments when leaders in the region break the mold of expected behavior. What do I mean by that? King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, in 2002, he was the crown prince at that point, sat down with Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, gave him an interview in which he said, "I'm ready to lead the Arab world to peace with Israel. I'm ready to have 23 Israeli embassies flying Israeli flags in every capital of the Arab world to end the conflict and to normalize relations with Israel." That was one of those moments. The Saudis were always very reluctant to be involved in the peace process. They were the caboose on the peace train. And suddenly, he's standing up and saying he's ready to go. That's what I mean by breaking the mold of expected behavior. And it was at that moment that the president had to get on his plane and go off to Riyadh and say, "Come with me, we're going to Jerusalem. We're going to pray in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And then we're going to talk about how we're going to make peace between Israel and the 23 Arab states." Those moments will come again, but we cannot predict them. We have to be ready for them. And when they come, we have to grab those leaders' hands and lead them to the promised land of peace and not let go. When Hafez al-Assad said he was ready to finish it, but he needed to do it quickly, that was a sign. And we missed it. And it changed the whole dynamic in a way that, I believe, made it impossible to make the deal with the Palestinians, let alone the Syrians. So when those moments occur, we have to seize them and not let go. Finally, with all the will and even guile of an effective American diplomacy, we can't do it on our own. The reality is that we have to have leaders in the region who are prepared to break the mold of conflict and make the peace. We can't tell when those leaders will stand up, but we know that without them we can't make the peace. When Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin decided to resolve their conflict, Jimmy Carter could bring home the Israeli-Egypt peace treaty. When King Hussein and Yitzhak Rabin decided to end their conflict, we could get an Israel-Jordan peace treaty. So we need the leaders there. But we also know that they can't do it on their own. That without the direct involvement of the United States, and in particular the U.S. president at the critical moments of when the compromises, the hard compromises have to be made, the peace deals cannot be achieved. So engagement, diplomatic engagement, a sustained diplomacy can put the leaders to the test. But when they stand up, we are then put to the test and the American president has to make the difference. It is, ladies and gentlemen, not a hopeless effort, as difficult as it may seem today. We are not doomed to fail. And I believe that if we try, we might just succeed. Thank you very much. Thank you. You see, these ladies and gentlemen have microphones, and I'm told we're going to take some questions. But you have to wait for the microphone, and you have to ask a question. So let's start here, please. And it would be very good if you could identify yourselves, too.
Richard Moyer. With Hamas, is it willing to sacrifice its own people to develop publicity all over the world that's anti-Israel? How do you feel that particular aspect of this conflict will play out? Because they and Hezbollah both are extraordinarily militant, radical groups.
It's a real conundrum. How can we hope to make peace between Israel and the Palestinians if the Palestinian leadership is so divided between Abu Mazen and Salam Fayyad and the Palestinian Authority, which controls the West Bank, and Hamas, which controls Gaza? Between Abu Mazen and Salam Fayyad, who want to make peace with Israel and speak out against violence, and Hamas, that says it will make a ceasefire, an informal ceasefire with Israel, but will not recognize Israel, will not renounce violence, and in fact argues that violence, what they call resistance, is the way to liberate Palestine. It creates a circumstance in which you don't have a unitary Palestinian actor committed to making peace and capable of enforcing any undertakings that, that would be agreed to in a peace agreement. So somehow there has to be an effort to unify the Palestinians and to get Hamas to support a peace negotiation with Israel, as well as renouncing violence. It seems like a very high bar. But in fact, there is a way, I think, at least to try it. The first requirement is a sustained ceasefire in Gaza, in which Hamas is committed to policing that ceasefire and committed not to import offensive weapons into Gaza. And in exchange, the Israelis open the passages and allow the free flow of goods in and out of Gaza, and people, the Egyptians would open the crossing for people to flow into and out of Egypt. That would, if Hamas was ready to feed the people that it now controls in Gaza rather than firing rockets at Israel, you would, in effect, have the beginnings of a peace process. Then there would have to be a reconciliation process between Hamas and Fatah, between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. That process is beginning in Gaza, in Cairo. Began actually yesterday, in which the Arab states are now involving themselves in this effort at a reconciliation. There's no point in such a reconciliation unless the result is that Abu Mazen, as the leader of the Palestinians, is authorized to negotiate with Israel. And that will be the test of that reconciliation. Will Hamas, at least its ministers that will go into some kind of reconciliation government, be prepared to support a negotiation with Israel? And that's what the Arab states are trying to effect now. So, again, you know, it's easy to be skeptical. There's good reason to be skeptical. But there may be, coming out of this latest horrendous crisis in Gaza, an opportunity to exploit the pragmatism of Hamas that comes from the fact that this terrorist organization now controls territory. It is, in fact, a government. And it has to decide whether, as I say, it's going to fight or it's going to feed. And if it's going to feed, that's the element which gives us the opportunity to try to moderate their behavior. Down in the middle there, yes, with the brown sweater. Yes.
Yes, thank you. I'm Harris Ominsky. If one of the major problems is innocence abroad and lack of knowledge about the societies, how do you resolve that issue other than having our leaders read your book?
Well, that's a good place to start.
And who would you point to? Which country, major power, would you point to in the past years which does not have this innocence about the Mideast? What would be your examples?
Yeah. I actually think that Turkey is the country that we should look to. It should not be a Western country, because I think Europeans tend to suffer from the same blind spot. But the Turks, as Ottomans, ruled this part of the world. The Turkish government now is an Islamist government, which has credibility with the Arabs. But the Turks have also had a strategic alliance with Israel that goes back to the 1950s. And notwithstanding the strain in relations that has erupted as a result of the Gaza crisis, the Turks actually have not only a good feel for a part of the world that they know very well and share a history with and a culture as well. The Turks are uniquely placed, of course, between, you know, the world of the East and the world of the West. And they've always been in that position. So I think that's the answer. And that's why I'm so happy to see Mitchell and Clinton going off to Ankara, because I do think that they can, with their relationships and their understanding of the region, play a very useful role partnering us. We've never done that before because they've never actually been in the position to do it. But they now are quite effective in Iraq with the Palestinians, with the Syrians, and also offering to help us with the Iranians. So I think that's the way we should go. Yes, please. Wait for the microphone.
In every one of these talks is settlements and the closed borders around Gaza. And in both instances, whenever I hear American diplomats talk about the issue, those issues are never addressed.
I'll be happy to address them.
All right. And in that context, two pieces of information I'd like are, what are the numbers in terms of expansion since Taba to today of Israelis now living in West Bank, new settlements? And what's the impact of keeping the borders closed, and address also the firing of the diplomat who was just fired in Israel for advocating for the opening of the borders?
He wasn't a diplomat. You're talking about the Israeli mediator with the Egyptians. He's just been reappointed. In Israel, it's you've got to keep on watching the headlines. let me start with settlements, and then I'll go to the crossing issue. I say in the book that one of the lessons of our efforts to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was that there were two things that did more to undermine the process of building trust, which is so critical to resolving conflict. And those two things were Israeli settlement activity and Palestinian resort to violence, terrorism. And what's essential now, because there is so little faith on both sides in the two-state solution as a solution, because what Palestinians see is more settlement activity. And by the way, Hamas makes the argument, you know, through violence we were able to get the Israelis to evacuate all the settlements in Gaza. And you, the Palestinians who negotiate with Israel, haven't been able to get them to remove one. In fact, they've expanded. And so it really undermines the credibility of the Palestinian negotiators. And so if you're going to restore faith in the two-state solution, you've got to have a settlements freeze, including natural growth. And there's no reason for expanding settlements now. I think the whole thing was a folly from start to finish for Israel. But it's time that the Israeli government live up to commitments that Israeli governments have made. To the Bush administration, to President Bush, that they would support a settlements freeze, including natural growth, and dismantle the settlement outposts. By the same token, the Palestinians have to stop the violence. You can't have a peace process predicated on violence. and they have to dismantle the infrastructure of terror. Now, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has begun to do that, has begun to, with our help and Jordanian help, to build a credible security service which is now being deployed in the cities and towns of the West Bank, first to restore order, but also to start to arrest people that would undertake violent activity against Israelis. A lot more needs to be done in that direction, but at least it's moving. If there is a ceasefire in Gaza, as I explained in answer to the first question, which Hamas is policing, including not just Hamas fighters, but all the other ragtag mobs there, that begins, again, to address the need to stop the violence. And so in this way, settlements freeze, an end to violence, dismantling the infrastructure of terror, can hope to rebuild confidence in the process. By the way, this is a little bit beyond your question, but I think it's important to understand it, tie together. The fact that the Arab states are now offering to end their conflict with Israel provides an opportunity to enhance this confidence-building process by having the Arab states also engage with Israel as Israel freezes settlement activity, so that the Israelis can see that this is not a two-state solution, but potentially a 23-state solution. And that can provide a positive incentive for what is politically a difficult thing, for especially for a right-wing government to do. Now, sealed borders, thank you. I hadn't forgotten. The issue here is very straightforward. If Hamas stops the violence, the passages need to be opened. If Hamas stops the smuggling, the passages need to be opened. And there's a deal to be done here. It needs to be finalized now. The elements are there. But that is the basic deal. For the last year, Israel, the United States, were a year and a half, were trying to squeeze Hamas to, in effect, undermine its control in Gaza. And it was basically a policy of regime change. The Israelis, when they went in with force to stop the rocket fire onto Israeli towns, stopped short of removing Hamas. They did not do it. And the consequence of that is that Hamas is still in control in Gaza. And the Israelis took a decision not to remove them. And so now what has to be done is to create a modus vivendi in which the people of Gaza are no longer the victims, have a chance to rebuild their lives. For that, the passages have to be open. For that, the violence has to stop. It's a straightforward deal. And I think there's an opportunity to do it now. Let's take one up the back there.
See if I can say this in a way that makes some sense. It seems to me that American government support, both in Congress and the President, is completely and unfailingly supportive of Israel, as if it's almost a discussion that touches a third rail, when the American government will never contemplate a discussion about Israel's responsibility for what's going on and pressure Israel in a way that might move the process a bit faster. Why is that?
Well, it's partly political and it's partly diplomatic. It's political in the sense that Israel enjoys broad-based bipartisan support. That over the years, it started in the Democratic Party, but has spread to the Republican Party because of the Republican Party's conservative evangelical base. There's a very strong pro-Israel constituency in this country and in the Congress. And so a president that wants to, as you said, pressure Israel has to understand that he's going to face strong opposition to that politically. But there's also a diplomatic explanation that I talk about in the book and believe strongly. And that is that if you're a diplomat that wants to, an American diplomat that wants to make peace in the Middle East, Israel is more than 50% of the equation, because it's a territories for peace deal. It's the only way it's going to work. And Israel has to give up the territory that it occupied as a result of the 1967 war if a peace deal is to be made. How are you going to get Israel to give up that territory? By denying it aid, and understand today, Israel doesn't get economic assistance from the United States. It used to for a long time. Its assistance is all military assistance for the means of helping it defend itself. So if you're going to cut the military aid, the signal you send to the Israelis is you're not going to be there to support them militarily. And so what that produces is, instead of greater flexibility, a digging in of heels. And so what an American diplomat finds is that it's much more effective to try to work with an Israeli government and get it to take risks for peace and underwrite those risks for peace, rather than try to beat it over the head, face a firestorm in Congress, and the result is likely to be counterproductive. And then what you do is debase your currency with the other side. You see, the Arabs come to Washington, even though we're so closely aligned with Israel, because their calculation is that we can use our influence with Israel to resolve their grievances with Israel. Anwar Sadat started that. He said, you know, the United States gives Israel everything from a loaf of bread to a Phantom jet. Of course, he was exaggerating about the loaf of bread. And that's why I'm going to Washington, because Washington can influence Israel. So, you know, listening to this, you're probably saying, well, that's exactly my point. The United States should use its influence to pressure Israel. And I say, yes, but to pressure Israel in a more effective way, which is to put your arm around the Israelis and help them move forward. Now, that works fine when you've got a Yitzhak Rabin or an Ehud Barak who wants to make peace, who's ready to take the risks for peace, and you can get behind them and underwrite them and work with them. What do you do with a narrow right-wing government led by Bibi Netanyahu? That was the challenge that we faced in the middle years of the Clinton administration. And we did press him to move. We weren't prepared to cut aid, but we did press him to freeze settlements. We did press him to yield territory per the agreements of the Oslo Accords. And eventually he did it. And his government collapsed and he was defeated. And he was defeated because he was seen to have mismanaged the relationship with the United States. Israeli public won't reward Israeli leaders who have a good relationship with the United States, but they'll punish those who mismanage the relationship, because we are so important to Israel. And Bibi Netanyahu knows that today. That's why he wants to try to form a broad-based national unity government, because he knows if he has a right-wing government, he's not going to be able to make the territories for peace deal in the West Bank. And he's not going to be able to freeze settlements, because the right-wing government, the right-wing parties will demand more settlement activity. And he knows he's going to get in trouble with a popular American president named Barack Obama. So he's going to have to find a way either to form a national unity government or to divert us. And how will he divert us? In my opinion, having worked with him the last time around, is he will go off to Damascus, which is what he did the last time. He will try to make a peace deal with the Syrians, give up the Golan Heights, so as to get us off his back. And therefore, we'll get something out of him. It may not, as I say, it may not be the peace we want, but it will create an environment in which it becomes easier to move on the Palestinian track. Now, I know that's a very complicated answer, but that's the basic point here. It is complicated. We cannot just go in with a simple solution. Let's cut aid to Israel and we'll solve the problem that way. It doesn't work that way. Yes, please, with the orange tie, pink tie. Oh, okay.
My name is Bernard Katz.
Sorry.
My question to you is, is there a place for Egypt to be a mediator?
Egypt has an important role to play in the Gaza situation with Hamas because it borders Gaza. It has an intense interest in what happens there because it doesn't want instability there to flow over into Egypt, because it's Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood organization and the main opposition in Egypt is Muslim Brotherhood. So it has an intense interest in trying to stabilize that situation. That's why you see them actively involved there. But Egypt is resented in much of the rest of the Arab world. For instance, the Syrians will never look to Egypt to play a mediating role for them with Israel. They'd rather look to the Turks to do that than the Egyptians. And in the Gulf, there's a good deal of resentment to Egypt as well, because Egypt's the big power in the region, the largest, militarily most powerful Arab country. And so it can play a role in the specific circumstances, but it's not going to be the sole. We should not rely on Egypt alone, is what I'm trying to say, in order to get the Arab states involved. It's particularly important to engage the Saudis, precisely because they're talking about leading the Arab world to peace. Yes, please, down here. We can just wait for the microphone. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Look. Could I ask you to wait for 1 second?
Certainly.
I promised the guy up the back there that I would do
No problem.
Go ahead.
You mentioned that the United States is at a disadvantage in its negotiations because of its innocence or arrogance or ignorance, its failure to understand the real nature of the interests of the parties in the Middle East. Well, I know, and you spoke of Turkey as a possible alternative. But I'm wondering, I know that Iran is, the axis of evil. But I wonder.
I didn't say that.
No. Okay. Point taken. But I wonder if they labor under the same disadvantage.
Interesting question. I don't think they're innocent, nor ignorant. They are a civilization, a Persian civilization, with a long and proud history in this part of the world. But they are arrogant. They do consider themselves the rightful power in the region, that the empire of Darius should be somehow reestablished, that they should be dominant, at least in the Persian Gulf. They are making now a bid to be dominant in the region. In 2003, some of you may be aware that the Iranians, fearful of our power after we toppled Saddam Hussein and before we got stuck in the quagmire of Iraq, made an overture to us. It was called the Grand Bargain. They offered us a Grand Bargain. We like this word, Grand Bargain. I mean, the Bush administration didn't pursue it and it didn't go anywhere, but the concept of Grand Bargain sounded great to us in our innocence. We'd put all the issues on the table and resolve everything. Well, that's not what they meant by Grand Bargain. What they meant by Grand Bargain was we would divide the Middle East between us. Seriously. Between the American superpower and the Iranian superpower. And they would be dominant in the Gulf, and we would recognize that as their sphere of influence. And our troops would come out, and their they would be responsible for security in the Gulf. That's what they intended. And that's what they intend now. It makes me rather pessimistic about the chances of our effort to engage them. I think it's very important to test it anyway, but I think we should be realistic about that. That the Iranians intend to be the dominant power. There's an excellent BBC documentary, which I saw out in the Middle East last week, and it will eventually come here, and I strongly recommend it, about the US relationship with Iran. And what's interesting about it, and I didn't really understand it, is that we basically, when the Shah was in power, we basically conceded the Gulf to him. He was dominant in the Gulf in those days. But I don't see, and that's why the Iranians, I think, expect that we'll do the same deal with them now. I don't think that we can possibly sacrifice our interests with the Gulf Arabs, Saudi Arabia and the other GCC states, on the altar of a US-Iranian detente. Yes, please.
You just answered my question. I wanted you to address Iran. Thank you very much, which you just did.
Okay. We've got time for two more questions, I'm told. So let's take one over here, and then we'll come into the back. Yes, please. The gentleman in the corner.
I want to thank you for your insight. Having listened to you tonight and many times on TV, are we giving the benefit of all your knowledge and background to people like Mitchell and Hillary Clinton? Are we benefiting in this new government with your insight?
Yes. down the back there. No, halfway. Yes, right. Okay. All right, we'll come back.
After
that was a short question, we'll take one more.
After September 11th, when the United States went into Afghanistan and Iran worked with us because they also were enemies of the Taliban, why do you believe that after that George Bush put Iran, he had to make a mention in his State of the Union address calling Iran part of the axis of evil? Mm-hmm. Would there have been a better opportunity then to work with them somewhat? The second question is it in Iran's interest to keep riling up and in a way work with the Taliban, even though they're Sunnis, in Afghanistan, just because it kind of keeps us bogged down there, or is there any type of opportunity?
Yeah, very good questions. I think at the time it was a huge mistake to brand them as the axis of evil, precisely because, as I was saying in answer to the earlier question, they were looking for ways to cooperate with us. They were worried that we would in fact turn on them. At that point, once we went into, after Afghanistan, we went into Iraq and toppled Saddam Hussein so quickly, they were very fearful that we would turn right. And we actually were surrounding them in Afghanistan, in Kyrgyzstan and to their north, and in Iraq and, of course, in the Gulf itself with our Navy. And so they had a strong incentive to behave themselves and to cooperate with us. And as you say, they were cooperating in Afghanistan and I think would have been willing to cooperate with us in Iraq as well. And so now we have a chance to try to test that proposition again. I think that while they feared that we would use our strength to topple their regime, because after all, the Bush doctrine was one of regime change, they had every reason to, as you say, bog us down, tie us down, and build their capability to inflict damage on us, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. But their enemy is the Taliban. They understand that precisely, as you say, because it's Sunni, they're Sunnis, and they create instability on their eastern border. So we need to test the proposition. I'm not sure that the proposition is correct, but at least we should test it. You see, there's a lot of mistrust between the United States and Iran. We do not know each other. We have not talked to each other officially for 30 years. We have no feel for them. They have no feel for us. So we have to, if we're serious about trying to engage with them and getting them to take our interests into account, then Afghanistan and Iraq are the two places where we should try first, because that's where we may have a common interest with them. Those countries are on their borders. They cannot want those situations to destabilize in a way that will spill over into their country. So at least we should test there, because we may be able to, again, coming back to the notion of building confidence, we may be able to build confidence in the motives of each other that will make it easier to deal with all the other problems that we're going to face. Okay, I promised the last question to the gentleman. He's wearing a brown shirt, brown sweater there, yes. He looks like Ehud Barak. No, behind it, behind. Sorry.
I have such a great question.
Sorry. We'll do it personally afterwards.
Thank you. To what extent does the current economic situation in Iran, due to the lowering of oil prices, affect their material support for these movements, especially when you consider the rest of quality of that youth culture there?
Yeah. I don't, you know, they're giving Hezbollah, I think it's about $200 million a year. That's not going to be significantly affected by the drop in oil revenues. Hamas is quite a bit less, I think. I don't think we really have a good sense of how much they give to Hamas, but Hezbollah is their main operation. So it's not going to affect them that way. But $40 a barrel oil will have a profound economic effect. It will give a turbo boost to the sanctions now in existence. And that, combined with Ahmadinejad's mismanagement of the Iranian economy and his splurging of what surpluses they had from the windfall of oil at $140 a barrel, has meant that the Iranians are going to face real problems. And it's interesting to see, if you go back historically, you see that when oil dropped dramatically in the 1990s, Mohammad Khatami, the reformer, was elected president, and the Iranians looked to try to achieve a rapprochement with the United States. My money is on Ahmadinejad, actually, but I've never managed to predict anything correctly in the Middle East. By the way, I don't know anybody else who has as well. But in the end, it's important to understand that Iran, excuse me, is only partially a democracy. Ultimately, it will be the decision of Khamenei, the supreme leader, and if he wants to normalize relations with the United States, which is by no means clear, I suspect he will tilt the process in favor of Khatami, the reformer. But if he has doubts about it and wants to maintain the revolution, then he'll probably stick with Ahmadinejad. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.